Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 2nd, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Michael Cobbler. It's session number 98-3 and is titled Building Powerful Communities, One-to-Ones. Let's listen in.
I am Michael Cobbler. I am a lead organizer of Toledoans United for Social Action, also known as Toledoans USA or TUSA. And my work as a lead organizer is to make sure that Toledoans United for Social Action does not become Toledoans usually sitting around. Please take copies and pass them around. Let's see, may need one more, I think. Yes, we have to flip upstairs. Thank you. I am one of the members of the Valparaiso gang that's here. I don't know if we'd say this in Valparaiso, but in Toledo, we would probably say the posse, the Valparaiso posse that's here. I live in Valparaiso. But as evidenced by this, I work in Toledo. Yes, indeed, 200 miles to the east of Valparaiso, along Route 8090, which I'm very familiar with.
That's quite a commute.
And I live in a Roman Catholic rectory during the week in Toledo, so I should make that clear. I don't make that drive every day. We have three more sheets left, so I want to make sure that everybody has a copy. If you don't have a sheet, raise your hand. Okie dokie. That's fine. Okay, and beyond the 20 that was made, you'll need to share somehow. But at any rate, today's session on building powerful communities is entitled One-to-Ones or One-on-Ones. Actually has to do with conversations that are held among people in a neighborhood or an organization in order to become aware of each other's self-interest. Now, some of you are new to all what's going on, so I'll try to do a quick recap. But these sessions can stand by themselves, but the other piece is in the work of community organizing, the concepts kind of build on one another. So a little background will certainly help. On Monday, we had conversations around power and what it means to build power in community or to have power. A definition of power is the ability to act or the ability to help or to harm. And the work that is done in congregation-based community organizing centers around teaching communities that are often viewed or even have a self-perception of powerlessness to become powerful on the basis of the values that they hold as people of faith or goodwill. That's what we do in Toledo, and that's what's done in a host of communities, both rural and urban, around the nation. The other concept that was spoken about on Tuesday is self-interest. The one way to build power is to organize people around their self-interest. That which is most passionate to them, which is their life's quest. So First of all, one needs to identify his or her own self-interest and then be in conversation with others to identify their self-interest. We also spoke about public and private relationships, how in private relationships, which we don't have a lot of, and mostly centered around family and possibly a few friends, relationships are based on love. In the public arena, relationships are based on respect, ideally. And there's a lot of negotiation that has to be done. So that's the kind of work we do in congregation-based community organizing. It centers itself around the public arena so that communities can build power and get respect through their self-interest and the cultivating of relationships. Let's have a word of prayer. Oh, gracious and ever-living God, your being is constituted on relationships. Yea, even creator, redeemer, sanctifier. We ask you now as we seek to build and cultivate relationships that not only enrich our lives, but enrich the lives of others, that you give us a double measure of your spirit and reach into our hearts as we seek to hold conversations that matter and conversations that lighten the burdens of life and give hope and strength to those who speak a word not only of information but of hope to one another. We pray this will come to pass in the conversations we have not only here, but in our lives back home. We pray this in Jesus' precious name. Amen. Any questions, first of all, from a Tuesday session or even Monday session about power or self-interest? If you weren't there, some of the stuff will bubble up even today. But this session, probably more than the others, stands very well on its own because it is the tool that we use in congregation-based or values-based community organizing to build relationships.
Are you talking about congregation-based?
Congregation-based or institutional-based community organizing, yes indeed. And we say congregation-based and institutional-based because some community organizations that don't organize around individuals solely will also allow institutions to be involved, hospitals, schools, neighborhood organizations. In fact, where I serve as an organizer, there are two neighborhood organizations that are part of the organization as members. Now, their base is not faith-based, but a neighborhood base, but they are involved nonetheless. So it's not just congregations or churches that can be involved in this kind of work, but they are but institutions also. So, any questions about those concepts or power and self-interest? If
you could maybe give me a 30-second distinction between selfishness and self-interest.
Okay. We call self-interest the third way between selfishness and selflessness. In a strict sense, neither selflessness nor selfishness is constituted on relationships. you don't need anybody else to give all your stuff away. You see what I mean by that? In fact, I often use in training the example of Mother Teresa, because I ask people, you know, who do you know as a selfless person? And Mother Teresa is always mentioned among the first three. But then I say, well, for Mother Teresa to do what she did and to found an order as she did, do you think she was clear about what she wanted to do? Do you think that she pushed an agenda in order to accomplish what she wanted to do? And it's amazing, the people from Minnesota answer, yeah, you betcha. And of course, you know, part of the language of, you know, selflessness and selflessness will have them be, you know, kind of opposite to one another. In organizing, we say that they're in the same park. It's not, you know, you don't have to have a relationship to give your stuff away, and you don't have to have a relationship to keep all your stuff. Amen. So what we say, self-interest, and like lawyers, we borrow from the Latin, self-inter-esse, self among or between to be or being, self among being. And you don't have to make too much of a leap to turn that into self among community or self among reality. So self-interest is what one's passion is in context to the body politic, if you will. We are in fact in organizing, crafting a different language is not necessarily new, but it's certainly a different language from what you often hear. And of course, you hear people say self-interest groups. Well, I think it's great that there are self-interest groups, you know, because they are pushing their agenda in community. You know, we organizers don't find that selfish at all, but politicians will tell you otherwise. So I hope that's helpful for you.
Very good, thank you.
Now for a definition of one-to-ones, or one-on-ones. And it's on your sheet. An intentional, scheduled conversation with a person, not a sales pitch, in order to initiate or build a relationship in the public arena. And I want to underscore those first few words, intentional schedule. The important thing about the one-on-one is you, in effect, raising the bar with another human being about as regards to the development of a relationship in the public arena. An example, in Columbus, when I was a pastor of First English Evangelical Lutheran Church, and I was pastor there for 5 years, we had a terrible problem in the neighborhood with abandoned homes. It seemed like there were three or four on every block. And you know, we had other problems too. I mean, prostitution, drugs, crime, you know, just usual in the city stuff. And at first, the perception neighborhood was, well, you know, after all, this is the Near East Side of Columbus. This is to be expected. You know, you find a body in a garbage can once every 2 weeks. That's to be expected. That's just the way of life. In the Near East Side, in the hood, as people would say. I didn't expect it. There are other folk that didn't expect it. And we started having conversations with one another about, well, let's see if this, you know, expectation that allegedly exists is really true. So we set about 10 of us having conversations with neighbors. And this was not done in a, this was done in a very systematic way. We did start with people who at least knew us, and there are a few of those, and set appointments with them to have conversations. And then the 10 of us had 10 conversations each. And part of our conversations were to, as we found out what was important to the people in the neighborhood, and also what concerns they had, what their life story was, if they would be interested, not necessarily at the first visit, but in subsequent conversations, proposition them to be in conversation with at least 5 other people. And so the conversations grew until there were about 750 conversations over what's important and what's the passion of people in the Near East Side took place. Eventually, the organization that was developed out of all this, the Columbus Organizing Project, then renamed Building Responsibility, Equality, and Dignity, if you were thinking that acronym is BREAD, some 2,000 conversations across the city of Columbus eventually took place. What we found out was that crime, drugs, abandoned homes, and the whole lot was not the expectation of the neighborhood. In fact, folks were pretty angry about it, but they didn't know where to turn. Well, out of those conversations, we figured out where to turn. And we had an action on, now I'm skipping a lot of steps, but we eventually had an action on an abandoned house that was owned by the state of Ohio by forfeiture, which means the owner, you know, didn't pay taxes, nobody wanted to bother with it. So by forfeiture, it belonged to the state of Ohio. Now, in those circumstances, I mean, it's really nobody's property. But what was happening on that property is there were rats running rampant, open windows where people would crawl in, smoke crack, crawl back out. It was an absolute mess. But being in Columbus, we had an opportunity. We saw an opportunity to deal with this. And in fact, it was Father's Day a year ago, had a demonstration of 250 people who signed a letter that eventually became that big, and we marched from St. John Holy Rosary Roman Catholic Church to this property a block and a half away, and did an exorcism on the property. I was outstanding. I was in my chasuble. Oh, we were, you know, sensing the joint. My Roman Catholic colleague, he brought his asperger and he was sprinkling water on it. You know, it was just outstanding. We had all the media out and we had signs that said, "Fix it up, George, or tear it down." This is a reference to Governor George Voinovich.
He was he.
Yeah, yeah, right. Who's he? The governor of Ohio.
All right.
Oh, it belonged to the state of Ohio, so it was George's responsibility as far as we were concerned. He had big pictures of him, and he said, "Fix it, George, or tear it down." You know, Voinovich is a slum landlord. Oh, it was outstanding. And all the press just thought it was wonderful. We had testimony of a mother who's 18. She opened her car door, and a big rat jumped out, and a rat running over the foot of an 18-month-old baby. Hey, oh yeah, you know, we built it up big. But all these testimonies came from stories of the neighbors. There was a garage in the back that was decrepit and needed to be torn down immediately. So what happened was that all that wound up in the paper the next day in the Columbus Dispatch. And then to continue putting on the heat, we marched down to, actually it wasn't a march, we just kind of all gathered in our cars, about 50 of us, and went to the governor's office. But first they weren't going to let us in. We had this big sign, of course the media was hip to this and they were following us around. And this big letter, we're going to present to the governor, fix it up or tear it down, and about a dozen placards. And the guard said, you can't take any of that stuff upstairs. And then I said, what do you mean you can't take it upstairs? You know, we're delivering this to the governor. They said, well, you can take letters upstairs, but you can't take signs. And then I said, well, this is a letter. It just happens to be big. And they said, okay, the letter can go up, but you can't take the placards. And then I turned to the body and I said, people of bread, these guards, who, by the way, work for us, are telling us that we can't take our placards upstairs. Is that acceptable? They said, no! And the organizer was looking at me like I'm crazy. take the letter upstairs already. You gotta win. Don't go crazy. And then I say to the guard, the people who pay your salary say this is unacceptable. What are you going to do about it? Well, you can't take that upstairs. And I turn to the people again. People of bread, these guards, whose salary you pay, will not let you take placards upstairs. Is that acceptable? And they say, all the more, no! And then I turned to the guard and I said, it looks to me like you have some very angry people here. What you going to do about that? Are you going to let them take it upstairs or what? And they said, no. And I turned to people of bread and I said, people of bread, these guards, whom you are angry at, and whose salary you pay, will not let you take these upstairs. Is that acceptable? And by this time, they're no! And I'm saying, I turn to God, well, I guess there's only one thing we can do. And they got a look of terror on their face. The state highway patrol is starting to show up, and the organizer is going to me like this. You know? So I say, and this comes from the power of the collective, I say, all right, take out your pens and pencils. Put Dear Governor Voinovich at the top of your placard. At the bottom, put sincerely your name and your address. And then they do that, and I turn to the guards. It's a miracle, the placards have become letters. What are you going to do now? And they just look at us and we march upstairs. But that's what you can do when people are focused on what they want and they're organized, great things can happen. There are, as we shared earlier this week, there are but two, all power certainly comes from God, but as far as human beings are concerned, there are only two sources of power, organized money and organized people. Yes?
What happened to the house?
Oh, we won big time. By Wednesday, the garage in the back was totally torn down. All the overgrowth was taken away. The governor apparently put in a very displeased call to the Department of Health, the City Department of Health. And then all of that was taken care of. The house was boarded up completely. There was 90 gallons of trash removed from the underside of the porch. And then the porch was repaired also. All that was done within, all done and completed, and the house was fumigated all within 1 week. Oh yeah, we won big on that one. And in fact, the health department was an adversary for a while, but I can now say in Columbus, the director of the City Department of Health actually made a public presentation and said, I was offended by the BREAD organization at first because of their anger. But then he said, but then I learned over time that it was anger with a purpose and a focus. And now I am an ally. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, yeah. Bill Myers didn't want to even say the name of BREAD, but he said, he was 1 year ago, he would say, watch out for those people, you know, to tell his colleagues and stuff. And now, they're working cooperatively on a host of projects in not only the Near East Side of Columbus, but all over the city of Columbus. So that's the kind of stuff can happen out of folk having conversations with one another and intentional conversations. You know, we used to do a lot of this. We used to sit on the porch, you know, and talk about what's important. You know, what do we have now? The mall. Huh. You know, you can't talk about what's important at the mall. And you know, we run out of our house, we jump into our cars, we drive away. You know, our houses are not much more than places to sleep and eat. So how do you recover community? You have intentional conversations, one-to-ones. So, reasons for one-on-ones, or one-to-ones, is to build relationships in the public arena. You see them listed on number 5. Uncover person's self-interest, to clarify, and clarify in terms of, that's related to the role or the intention of a person or their office. I mean, different, you know, if you say, if somebody says in the city, I'm the mayor, that may mean a lot in one city and not so much in another. I'll just use 2 Ohio examples. If the mayor, you know, the mayor of Columbus says, I'm the mayor, that's pretty important because Columbus has a strong mayor system, as does Toledo. But you say that in Cincinnati, the mayor is not much more than a figurehead, though they're trying to make it stronger. And the city council and city manager have a more authority. So what role a person plays or their office, you know, is significant. And plays, you know, plays out the same way in communities. You know, whether you have, you know, neighbor next door or the ward leader or whomever. And also you're seeking information because in the organization you want to be able to make what we call, excuse me, a power analysis. You know, who really calls the shots around here? Is it internally, externally? And then is this person a figurehead? Is this person taking instructions from someone else? So you want to have as many one-on-ones as you can to find that kind of stuff out. Not to mention the one-on-ones that you want to have in the neighborhood to uncover the self-interest of the neighborhood. What you need to do a one-on-one is curiosity and courage. Because you're doing more than talking about the weather. Now some guidelines, quickly run through those, because these are important. Like I said, we're raising the bar for developing relationships. So you set an appointment and you confirm it the day before. Now, you know, folk in business know about this. You know, that's standard operating procedure. But folk in neighborhoods don't always do this. You know, you see somebody on the run. Oh, yeah, let me call you. Yeah, I'll call you. Yeah, okay, let's have lunch. Oh, we'll have lunch, you know. Yeah, you know, my people talk to your people. Yeah, all that kind of stuff. Well, you set an appointment and you confirm it the day before. That lets the person you made the appointment with know that you are serious. You allow at least a half hour of time for conversation. We won't be able to replicate that today, but you allow a half hour. You make it face to face. It's not a phone call. It's not while you're doing the laundry in the laundromat. And I even resist doing it over a meal because, you know, when I'm eating, what I'm concentrating on is eating. I'm not concentrating on another person. I mean, that's me.
Mm-hmm. And it's not email.
And it's no, thank you, yes. And it's not email. Goodness gracious, a lot. Right, that's not email.
How about where?
Ideally, if it's a neighbor in their home, and then you ask them that, you know, if it can be arranged that it's during a quiet time, you know, where they're not looking after children or doing the wash themselves, or and if there's a need to facilitate, and I find this from time to time, you know, it might be a young mother or something want to have a conversation with, needs facilitate, if there's a need to facilitate the conversation by you know, babysitting or something, you know. If they can't make it happen and they're clear about not being able to make it happen, you can help make it happen. You know, bring along a kid who could babysit or something. You know, I've done that sort of thing. Because once again, like I said, we're raising the bar for the development of relationships. So you want them to let the person know you're serious about listening to them.
If it's somebody in government, you want to go to their office, or you want to go to some neutral place?
Office would be ideal. Yeah, their office, and of course, they usually have the wherewithal that they can meet with you without any hindrance. Sometimes it's tough to get an appointment, but it's important to be persistent.
Mike, at what point do you communicate the subject matter to be discussed?
That can be a variable. Well, it is a variable, in fact. Of course, with a public official, it may be a particular project that you want information about. But neighbor to neighbor is usually finding out what's in their head and their heart and a little bit of their background. There's a sentence that we use in terms of uncovering self-interest, you know, what's important to a person. That we shared in Tuesday's session. What made you who you are? And you almost think of that as two units. You know, what made you? The shaping forces of your life. Who you are, you know, what roles do you now play? You know, mother, wife, husband, school teacher, you know, there may be a host of roles that you play in your life. A caregiver of a senior parent, there's a host of them. Those are important things to know. And those are the kind of things you seek out. And then what you further seek out is, and where are you going? You know, what are their hopes, dreams, passions? Yes?
Are you guys like planning on doing anything more to like these other abandoned houses that you said there were like three or four of on each block?
Oh, there's significant work going on in Columbus. Just to back up to that, BRED is now a very powerful organization. They're getting tax abatements for homeowners as a whole piece of work being done around transportation. So there's a number of areas in which a lot of good things are being done. Yes, yes.
You mentioned neighbors in the neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
public officials.
Right.
What about if you were trying to get to know business leaders and business people? What's the best form to do that?
It would be similar to public officials if there is a business that you want to get to know, try to move as much as possible. We like to say the higher the better. If you can talk to the CEO, all well and good. If there's a vice president for community relations, that's fine. But you want to talk to a person, ideally, that you at least have a sense would have a significant role or would make significant decision related to a problem that your organization is investigating. It could be, university that, is taking over more land in the, let's say St. Louis WashU, is taking over more property in a certain neighborhood and there's no give backs to the neighborhood. So you want to talk to the person who makes primary decisions related to the acquisition and use of that land, whether that's provost or, so you find out the right person to talk to and then, have a conversation with her. And it need not be adversarial. I mean, that's the other thing, is with a one-on-one, you're really seeking information and seeing what kind of role they play. So later on, they very well may be a target, but the first thing is to find information. Yes.
So for example, with a corporation or a institution,
mm-hmm.
Would you share it now?
Oh, example
yeah.
with one? Oh, mercy. Yes. Oh, there's a couple. For example, have had, let me use Columbus again instead of Toledo. There were significant conversations in Toledo, in Columbus, with some of you may know, the Limited and Les Wexner. He's one of the richest men, certainly the richest man in Ohio, one of the richest men in the country, and if you know about the Limited or Victoria's Secret, then you know about Les Wexner. We had conversations with their community people because we knew that there were a lot of jobs being generated in the northeast quadrant of Columbus, but there wasn't decent transportation to get there for people who lived in the inner city. We had a circumstance of there were a lot of people who needed jobs, but the jobs were out here. And so it was with his community relations people that we had significant conversation, and we wanted them to be allies on having the Central Ohio Transit Authority change some of their routes to be more accommodating in both in terms of where they went and also the times they went. There was, Central Ohio Transit Authority was saying stuff like, oh, third shift, you gotta be crazy. We don't run buses in the middle of the night. I said, well, you could have anywhere from 200, 300 people who want to get from point A to point B in the middle of the night, and that would be beneficial to you. We did research on the Central Ohio Transit Authority that said 80% of their ridership was based on 7 bus lines. They had 48. you think about that. We thought of it as a question of stewardship. So the Limited then became, once they realized that, then they became an ally in terms of adjusting those routes. And they have been adjusted.
What kind of leverage did you have to have? Was it a relationship with these individuals?
they just came to see your point of view, or did you have what kind of leverage did you have to use otherwise?
Well, what the leverage in that case was that they would have an available job force, and they wouldn't have to figure it out. You know, they wouldn't have to run shuttles at great expense to them to get, you know, their potential workers to the potential employers to the jobs that were found. So the leverage was, you know, they wouldn't have to bust their chops, but they had to speak to the commissioners of the outlying areas, because you know, everybody had their pet bus lines that, you know, had five people on them during the course of the day. So some of that had to be given up. But then the Limited is a big, and Les Wexner, you know, that's a big leverage. So if you have a Limited on your side, then that speaks to some power. And we recognize power speaks to power. So we have to cultivate allies to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, I understand what direction you're heading on this.
Mm-hmm.
When in motivating people to do things that you want them to do,
mm-hmm. Right?
There are several different strategies, and one, of course, that you mentioned was through intimidation.
That's one.
No, there are many others.
There are many others.
What,
indeed,
I think what you're saying is that we have to find out what people's interests are, and find from this background to lead them to come to a decision to help you with your problem.
Right.
And I think that's what you're leading into, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And there are many ways of doing that. Of course, what I would underscore in that is that we also say that there are, oh, what's the word to say it best? There are no permanent allies nor permanent adversaries, just permanent interests. And so it's important not to do anything goofy. You know what I mean? And we Lutherans in particular have a history of that in terms of what happened in Pittsburgh. Some of you may know about the alleged, as we now say, community organizing that went on in Pittsburgh with the IAF organization, Charles Honeywell, and the pastors that were involved. Well, Honeywell showed himself to be a renegade organizer. IAF was saying, even before stuff hit the papers, you have no business doing what you're doing, telling those pastors that they can disrupt worship services. You know, the church that the chair of U.S. Steel went to, and putting, you know, dead fish in people's lockers and stuff like that. You know, that's not values-based organizing from where I sit and a whole host of other organizers sit, because we have values, huh? That's why we call it faith-based. People of faith, you can put heat on people, and I and others sure enough have put heat on people, but you still treat them with respect. Now, there will be some who say that putting heat on people in and of itself is disrespectful. Well, I don't know about all that. If people want to be nice, I have a nice stance for something in organizing. Some of you may know it. Nothing is critically examined. That's what nice is. So I teach my leaders, don't be nice, or don't be, nothing is critically examined. You can be civil, you can be respectful, but you need not be nice. So it is, that's, we can go on forever about that. Now, what I'm fearing we are missing is a chance to practice one-on-ones ourselves, and to see it modeled. You can't do all that in 7 minutes. But I do think just go through these guidelines, and we had stopped at a half hour of time, or make it face-to-face. You don't write during a one-on-one. but you jot down notes afterwards. And what I have, who wanted to give this out, this is what was used in Columbus as a one-to-one summary. You write down the summary afterwards. It's a little like folk do verbatims. You don't write during the verbatim. You write afterwards. This is the same. You ask why questions when appropriate, especially in the public arena. When people talk about their families, you don't necessarily ask why questions. You know, we have three children. Why? that'd be kind of goofy. but in the public arena areas, you know, in terms of the work that they do, I married Thelma. Why? in public arena areas, it's important to ask the why questions.
Like why 80% of your passengers are on 7 lines or something like that.
Well, I heard that. Right, exactly. That's a good why question. But talk to a neighbor, you find out, their child goes to private school, you might ask why, and they might get a little tirade about how the public schools are not happening in that neighborhood. And that's important to know. And you see, you get at a little bit what that parent's passion is about, too. Probe, but don't pry. It's a fine line, to be sure. But you probe, but don't pry. You thank the person for the opportunity for the conversation at the end. And you bring it to some kind of closure. You say thank you. You'd be surprised how many one-on-ones happen, and somebody says, time's up, gotta go, see you later. No, you bring it to closure, thank them. And then, once again, raising the bar and setting relationships, you send them a brief note of thanks the next day. My own practice is that whenever I do a one-on-one, it doesn't matter who it is, that I conclude my work at the end of the day with writing thank you notes to those persons. And it's one of the things, you just do it. You can be amazed how much that can help to cultivate the relationship for the future. And remember, you're not making friends per se. You're building relationships and you're building respect. And so in doing that, this is gonna be quick. I want to volunteer. I want to model a one-on-one just to, and I will be asking the questions. Come on, Chuck. Let's give Chuck some courage to hear. And now Chuck never made an appointment. I've confirmed it. And we're gonna do this quick, fast, in a hurry. But I'm you will see that in why I'm asking, I'll try to uncover Chuck's self-interest.
And Chuck. I'm gonna be me.
And Chuck's back. And, okay. And Chuck's gonna be Chuck, exactly. Chuck, we really appreciate this opportunity to have a conversation with you. Tell me a little bit about your family, what's important to you, where you're from.
Okay, well, my wife and I live in Denton, Texas.
Okay.
And I have three stepchildren.
Ah.
And they're older.
Mm-hmm.
3 years ago, my wife's oldest stepchild died in an accident.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a significant traumatic event in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And our two daughters also live in Texas. They live in Dallas and in Austin.
Now, you've been married for how long?
14 years.
14 years.
Right.
And that's a blended family.
Yes.
And how was the experience of blending?
It was stressful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was stressful being newly married and having three teenagers.
So the children were teenagers at the time. Mercy. And you mentioned about the one child who died in an accident.
Yes, 3 years ago.
Oh, that recently then? Oh, mercy.
Yes, Sam was an adult. He was 6 weeks shy of his 30th birthday.
Oh, goodness. Now, how has that circumstance shaped family life since?
Following that, my wife left her job.
Mm-hmm.
She came up here for a London sojourn. Mm-hmm. This was a really good place for her to do some introspection. And she became involved in volunteer activities in the community.
Mm-hmm. What are those activities like?
An organic gardening society, master gardening. She became a master gardener. Gardening is a big deal in Texas.
Oh, okay.
And we're spending more time kind of thinking about our lives now rather than career kind of stuff.
Okay. Now, in your own career, tell me a little bit about that.
I'm on the faculty at a state-funded university,
mm-hmm.
and I teach in a PhD program,
mm-hmm.
in psychology.
Okay. What's your student load? How many candidates do you have to work with?
Let's see, I probably supervise, at any one time, 6 or 7 theses, dissertations. Okay. As far as supervising research, and then I also supervise clinical training and teacher organized courses.
Okay. It sounds to me that that you and your wife's name?
Diane.
Diane, okay. Have an affinity to Holden.
Yes.
How'd that come about?
I told you my wife came up here following Sam's death.
Right.
We knew about Holden from some friends in Phoenix. We're originally from Phoenix.
Okay.
And someone we knew at our home church there had always spoken about Holden, but we had never kind of bothered to come up and see for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something kind of we vaguely knew about, but my wife had an interest in seeking out a retreat following Sam's death.
Right.
So we're glad it was here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just for the sake of time, let's hold there. But you see a sense of what a one-on-one is about, and let's give Chuck Hardy that. Note that, you can imagine how a conversation extended over a half hour to 40 minutes it's something else what you can find out. Yes, indeed, Chuck.
Yeah, I was being fairly self-revealing. I'm imagining if you go to talk to someone, you may find a number of people who are less willing to provide information about themselves.
That's right. That's true. That's true.
Matters.
That's very true. That Chuck was very self-revealing in that regard. Yes.
One comment was I immediately noticed that you have fabulous listening body language. I mean, you were listening to him so well, and you were nodding your head, and you were, I'm sure you felt really comfortable that he was listening to you, and I think, you know, if you're going to send people out on that one-on-one, you almost want to coach that. I mean, you're such a good listener, and you were just kind of nodding your head. You know what I mean that by that body language that says, oh, I'm hearing it, and when he said, you know, the part about the sad part of his life, you immediately reacted, oh, gee, you know, I mean, you were really interacting with him immediately, and that was really... really neat, really good. I mean, I think you would, and people like you, with that kind of body language, you'd be able to draw people out even quicker by interacting that way, just simple nods of the head. And
yes, listening aspect is crucial. And that's why we try to encourage people, a host of people can do this, but the The key is that it's not a sales pitch.
Yeah.
No, I want you to be part of the organization and I will get you. No. That's the furthest thing we need to put from our minds in terms of it is a chance to listen. All right, Chris and then Linda.
I want to acknowledge that statement, but I've also had conversations similar to this where that kind of, just any kind of asking or even a little bit of probing completely turns a person off. I was talking to a university professor who I started to talk about, where are you from and mm-hmm. you met in St. Louis and that kind of thing, and she just about the second sentence into the conversation said, I feel like I'm being interviewed. Mm-hmm. So, and it didn't go very far. It was just a classic, very awkward moment. And then we just kind of said, oh, okay, well, let's get down to business, because there was another thing that we could talk about. So
okay.
Apparently
okay.
She saw this as a very business-oriented thing. So, I don't know what you do in times like that, but or how you set people up who might be a little bit concerned that they're going to be interviewed. And some people feel very resistant to being
mm-hmm.
interviewed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And it depends on the circumstance, but I always want to lift up that I want to hear about them, what's important to them, and certainly background information helps. But I try to craft as much as possible, and it's not always 100%, but craft as much as possible the context of the conversation, so they can determine ahead of time, if they feel that that's tantamount to an interview, they can say that, and we can talk it through even more. So it is something that has to be shape, but the key is to, most people will respond to two broad questions, tell me, tell me, you can finish that sentence any way you want, but that's a very powerful statement to make to a person, especially people that don't get to talk to anybody about anything, which is the context I work in, and also, what do you want? It's amazing how people light up to that, but it's those contexts. Linda, and then down here.
I was just curious to know, over the course of the half hour, if Chuck would have had the same opportunity to question you on your background and where you are right now, or is it all you questioning the person you're talking to?
We usually don't set it up that way, though it can happen. And then in our organizational gatherings, we do take time for folk to flip-flop, people from various congregations all gather together in the organization. Just about every meeting that we have, large meeting that we have, we will take anywhere from 15 minutes to a half hour if folk are doing many one-on-ones. And in that circumstance, we do it. But of course, the key in that is we're not asking the person to do a one-on-one. You share some about yourself, to be sure, but we're not asking them. At the close of the meeting, one of the things that could be asked is, are they willing to do that with others? And maybe the first person you practice on is me. But yes, indeed, that can be an option. All right, yes.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that you didn't really ask a lot of why questions. It was more of a how question, which is much softer and much more giving.
Right.
And that impressed me. Also about the give and take, and I think that's been addressed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the how questions can, you notice that a fair amount of our brief conversation, was on family matters. So it's kind of rough to ask the why questions in that circumstance. But the how, how it came to be, what's important in that regard, and we found out some things. And I still, even in this brief conversation, am very
And I admire the courage of Chuck to share as he did. I mean, that was a very powerful witness, and want to acknowledge that yet even again. Yes, okay, indeed.
Question. How open-ended is this process regarding, to be more specific, when you're interviewing, are you looking for issues where you might later focus in on them as agendas, house in the neighborhood?
Yes.
I said there are people who didn't get involved in that effort because they had other issues.
Right. That's right.
So you would note those, and if that issue did come up, so you would invite them to vote.
Right. In fact, we're addressing that big time tomorrow as we move from problems to issues, because what we find is, out of the one-on-one conversations, we find a lot of problems, but then how do we craft that as the organization to issues that can be cut? And we use that language very intentionally. I'll be talking about, a salami tomorrow, because you can imagine the problem as a salami, and you can't deal with the whole salami, right? But you cut a portion of the salami to make it manageable. And so you can, in fact, eat it. The salami is there to be eaten. So tomorrow we will, in fact, talk about how to cut issues, to move from problems to issues, to gather all those conversations in a systematic way, and then and actually negotiate with folk. Because what we can do is say, let's work on this now, but we will promise to work on this later. I mean, that can be done. And most folk will say, hey, if that's the case, I'll work with you now. All right, one more question, then we've got to go lunch for those who want to eat at the first shift.
It's not really a question, but it's a reflection, and that is, it seems to me, in the community in which I live in, it's fairly middle class, and mm-hmm. it's harder to find issues to organize around, perhaps, than in the inner city. Am I off base in assuming that? Because I'm thinking, how could I use this?
Right. Well, what we have found is that if a community concentrates on the conversations, something will be found. When I come to a community, I assume nothing. I just say to folk, let's start having the conversations. And once the conversations are held, I am convinced, at least, things will surface. Because, I walk into Ottawa Hills, which is, surrounded by Toledo, and a fairly, very rich community. And I say to some leaders there, are you absolutely happy with everything that's going on in your community? And nobody raises their hand. Here we are in Ottawa Hills. And you say, oh no, unhappy rich people, I don't believe it though. But then we start to have the conversations about the deep concerns about their children, deep concerns about is the city around them going to implode on them? I mean, real concerns there. They're but 1.5 miles from what we call old fairgrounds. And are the natives there going to kind of invade them? I mean, and it's a real concern. I mean, it's a public safety concern. It really is, surprising to most people, not race driven. It is driven by, we're rich, but are we safe? So I say to folk, have the conversations. In fact, when we started the organization in Columbus, people were saying things like, well, what's the issue? And I'd say, I don't know. And he'd say, but you got an issue, other people, otherwise people won't gather around you. I said, no. What we do is we cultivate relationships so that when the issues come,
there are people to gather together. And it's worked fabulously. Blessings to you all. We've gone on far too long, and I apologize for that. But we will tomorrow evening, and if you want to come to the session tomorrow evening, you need to eat first setting dinner. Just to just mention that, and then we'll gather at 6:20.